The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Welcome to the 2017 Internal Medicine Board Review Course, sponsored by the American College of Osteopathic Internists. The course was held March 22nd through 26th, 2017, at the JW Marriott Las Vegas Resort and Spa. The course featured nationally known speakers presenting a wide variety of topics of interest to the internist preparing for certification or recertification in the specialty of internal medicine. Disease of the thyroid is presented by Dr. John Sutton.
So, in regards to thyroid disease, we want to start out with iodide metabolism, synthesis of thyroid hormone. I think the most important step in this process for day-to-day practice of thyroidology would be organification, which is catalyzed by thyroid peroxidase. As you're aware, if you have thyroid peroxidase antibodies, which are very common in first world countries, then that blocks some of the synthesis of thyroid hormone and you get the diagnosis of Hashimoto. Thyroid antibodies, thyroid peroxidase antibodies are a test that you would routinely order. Years ago, this was called antimicrosomal antibody. It's basically the same test, but you probably can't order them, microsomal antibodies, currently. Thyroglobulin is the backbone to thyroid hormone, and we do antithyroglobulin antibodies as a part of the workup of a patient with thyroid disease. So in the production of thyroid hormone, most of it from the most of T4 is from the thyroid, and a small portion of T3 is from the thyroid. But for the most part, it is converted peripherally to T3 from T4, made in the thyroid, peripherally converted. We endocrinologists do not routinely order a test such as a reversed T3. It's more of an academic measure, and although you will have patients that you will see this result in, and I'm not sure why other doctors are ordering it. So for the most part, it's considered a different pathway of thyroid hormone production in a situation such as euthyroid sick. So only a very small percentage of thyroid hormone is bound. Only a very small percentage of thyroid hormone is unbound. Most of it is bound to substances such as thyroid-binding globulin, but it's the unbound portion that counts. So a very small percentage is unbound, referred to as free T4 and free T3. And if you need to measure unbound thyroid hormone, the best test to order is free T4. What I like to say in endocrinology is the test that they don't run as often, they don't do as well. And I see a lot of people ordering free T3. I'm not sure why they're ordering it. But as a routine, you don't need to do that. If you need free thyroid hormone, you order free T4. So production of thyroid hormone in T4 in the thyroid, 20% of T3 is in the thyroid and 80% is peripheral conversion. Almost every patient does this easily. So in these patients that come to you that say, I need T3, the designator of that really can be the TSH value, not the T3 value. And so if you've normalized their TSH, for example, with thyroid hormone T4, then measuring the T3 really isn't part of the mix. Okay. So free hormone is active metabolically, and so it's actually the free T3 that turns on or off the pituitary, but generally you don't routinely measure that. That is unbound thyroid hormone, and it is, again, converted peripherally into a T3 from T4, which your body naturally produces. When I first took the boards in 1994, IM boards, I saw these there were a fair number of thyroid function testing questions, and I think those are certainly fair questions to ask. And the reason I put total T4 as in TT4 is because after my endocrine fellowship, I took my medicine boards, and I saw that designation for the first time on my boards, which is TT4. I don't know exactly where it came from, but ultimately, when you talk about T4, you're talking about total T4, and you're not talking about active or free unless you use that word free. So it is integrally connected to thyroid-binding globulin. So if something else is affecting the thyroid-binding globulin, such as estrogen, then the total T4 will go up. So if you see an elevated total T4, and I'm not asking you to order that test, but the point of order is that you will sometimes get a result that you can't explain because the lab gives you extra tests, or if you order a panel of thyroid function, so you need to be able to explain those. And if most endocrinologists get many, many consultations on unexplainable thyroid hormone, and for us to be able to try to sort that out. So as thyroid binding globulin goes up, total thyroid hormone T3 and T4 go up. T3 resin uptake is inversely related to thyroid binding globulin. And we do not routinely order T3 resin uptake, but in recent years I have seen patients in whom I didn't order it, but another doctor ordered a thyroid panel and gave me a T3 resin uptake that I was asked to explain. We do measure TSH, but we don't measure thyroid binding globulin routinely, and we don't measure TRH, thyroid releasing hormone, although they're part of the mix in how to interpret thyroid function. So this is the lab slip that I got just a few years ago from a primary care doctor in Carson City. And what he ordered was a thyroid panel. And the lab gave him a TSH, T3 resin uptake, a total T4, and a free thyroxine index. So only one of those tests should you routinely check, which would be the TSH, but I think he ordered a thyroid panel. He ordered it on a patient that was postpartum a few weeks on thyroid hormone with a prior history of ablative therapy of the thyroid. So the patient was on thyroid hormone postpartum on birth control pills. So when I took a look at this and saw T4 up, T3 resin uptake down, what I said to myself is, I think this patient's on birth control pills. That's what it was. And the key there is if thyroid function tests are somewhat confusing, go back to the TSH, and except under very unusual circumstances, the TSH is going to explain itself. And in this case, we really didn't need to do any fancy testing because her TSH was high normal and she needed more thyroid hormone. What I'd also tell you is I routinely ask patients not to take their thyroid hormone right before the lab is drawn, maybe separate it by several hours or a day. So I usually say, don't take your thyroid pill on the day of the lab. Presumptively, you could have a high T4 if your patient took their Synthroid an hour before the blood draw, for example, and you might not be able to explain it. In this case, it was estrogen that was the problem. And estrogen doesn't cause thyroid dysfunction. It just makes the lab look funny. So, and we spend many days explaining this in consultation in endocrinology. So if you have a 50-year-old patient that has fatigue and weakness, depression, constipation, and weight gain, that looks like low thyroid function. You may also have slow relaxation, a slow relaxing phase to deep tendon reflexes, or also known as stretch reflexes, coarse skin, dry hair. So this is a gentleman from suburban Detroit. He has periorbital edema. He has a very tired-looking face, and he had actually was known to have a thyroid condition and had gone off of his thyroid hormone for many months for some unknown reason. So this is an image, a video of slow reflex relaxation phase. And this is what you'll see in a patient with severe hypothyroidism. And basically what it is, I'll show you again here. The uptick is okay, but the downswing is kind of slow and dragged out. That's known as pseudomyotonia. There are neurologic conditions that do this, but if the TSH is elevated, you want to treat the thyroid first. That would be primary hypothyroidism. In that lady's case, she had primary hypothyroidism from a thyroidectomy for thyroid cancer. So those patients we would expect to have an elevated TSH, but also possibly a low free T4. I was always trained that even if the free T4 is normal, if the TSH is elevated, that you treat that as hypothyroidism. Some people call it subclinical hypothyroidism, but in the case of the lady with the pseudomyotonia, that wouldn't be subclinical. High cholesterol, elevated CPK. What I say about that is that you need thyroid hormone to clear cholesterol. If you go back a few decades, thyroid function testing wasn't as good. You will have patients in this era that come to you that say they've read on the internet that it's still not any good, and that's not true. So a TSH can be run by almost any institution, and it's a good test, and you don't need to question it or what you know about it for however long you've been in practice or in training. The CPK sometimes can be elevated, and the significance of the high cholesterol is they used to use this in decades past when the thyroid function testing wasn't so good. Some docs would order a T4 and a cholesterol, and if the T4 was lowish and the cholesterol was highish, they would treat that as hypothyroidism because thyroid hormone is necessary for clearance of cholesterol. In first world countries, you can expect to see positive antibodies. You don't absolutely have to order them, although I think it makes the diagnosis more secure if you order antithyroid peroxidase antibodies and antithyroglobulin antibodies, and either one or both are positive, which they're going to be if you're practicing in the United States. They may not be as likely to be positive if you're practicing in rural Africa or Ethiopia. And I say that the big issue in Ethiopia is endemic goiter from iodine deficiency, but that's not the issue here in the United States. At the same time, in the United States, they don't need to be on any kind of a special diet to help their thyroid. In fact, if they are offered that from the health food store, they're potentially going to be offered iodine supplements, and that will provoke the thyroid. In the United States, there's already plenty of iodine. So another similar case would be a patient that presents to you with head trauma and hypo-HYPO tension, loss of consciousness in a motor vehicle accident, fatigue and weakness, pseudomyotonia. So a patient that presents with a history of head trauma, motor vehicle accident, and a thought that she might be hypothyroid, if the head trauma is part of that mix, then you might see low T3, low free T4, low TSH. The free T4 and the T3 are low, and the TSH is not responding appropriately. That would suggest that in this case, TSH alone wouldn't be a test that you could use alone, but you have to consider all of the history. And in that scenario, the TSH is inappropriately low because the T4 and free T4 are low. Now, a problem with this, you have to know your laboratory facilities. I have a lab facility near me in Northern Nevada at a hospital south of where I am. They don't know how to run a free T4. All the free T4s from that facility are low, and I don't really trust them. Now, you have some patients that can only go to that facility based on their insurance. Then you have to sort of work out what you're going to do about that. But I've gotten consults before from that institution based on the fact that they don't run a good free T4. And so you have to decide what you're going to do about that, try to potentially get it run at a different institution if you're considering secondary hypothyroidism. So in the treatment of secondary hypothyroidism, basically you'd need to decide why that happened and not just say head trauma, but you may need to evaluate other aspects of the pituitary, and you would probably need to do imaging of the pituitary to try to separate out the diagnostics. The treatment is the same for primary and secondary hypo-HYPO-thyroidism. The problem is with secondary, you don't have the TSH to help you make the designation. The goal in primary hypo-HYPO-thyroidism is to give levothyroxine, preferably in a brand name form, to try to normalize the TSH at or close to 1.0. Some patients, I advocate not talking really specifically about the TSH to your patients because they come to my office and talk about the pituitary because you've tried to explain to them that has something to do with the pituitary and they think they have a pituitary disorder. Sometimes I get into it if the patient is really educated and understands it, but otherwise I try to stay away from that, not to put words in their head that don't apply to them. In the case of levothyroxine, though, we prefer that you give brand name thyroid hormone. If you did choose generics, you have to assure that they're getting the same generic every month. And with the way insurance changes are and changes in pharmacies, you can't guarantee a consistent dosing. And generally, the generics are therefore not quite as reliable as brand name T4, Synthroid, Tyrosint, Levoxyl. Oral absorption is about 80%. So if you put a patient in the hospital and they need to be in the intensive care and they can't take anything orally and you think they're otherwise euthyroid, then you'd want to give them 80% of their admission dose. As far as secondary hypohypothyroidism, we shoot for a free T4 that is at the upper end of normal. And sometimes I measure TSH to see what's happening, but in most cases, if that's the clear diagnosis, the TSH is going to be low and you can't use it as effectively. The treatment titration is about a 6-week period. It takes the pituitary about 6 weeks to recover whatever's happened at the level of the TSH. Generally, we do more rapid titration in patients that are pregnant because we only have so much time to get the thyroid function into the normal range. We do usually do preconception counseling to try to secure that they should have the most normal thyroid function heading into a pregnancy. And generally, the requirements in pregnancy can be up to 1.5 times the normal value. We don't automatically increase that. I have a recent patient on very large dose of thyroid hormone that was able to stay on the same dose of thyroid hormone throughout her pregnancy, but you need to do serial testing in the midst of pregnancy and face-to-face visits. You want to avoid rapid titration in the elderly, and you want to avoid rapid titration in patients with coronary artery disease. I have seen at least one patient who had very severe hypothyroidism that had such severe coronary artery disease that I couldn't titrate up very rapidly, otherwise I got chest pain. He got chest pain, and then I got a little chest pain. But this was back in Michigan 20 years ago. And so you need to go slow, but it's possible that the patient might need to have some type of a revascularization before you can get them up to the right dose. And again, generally, no thyroid hormone the day of the thyroid lab test. Myxedema coma is something that is often discussed but rarely seen. The reason is all of you and myself are very good about checking thyroid hormone, even in patients that are fairly well. And so it is extremely rare that we don't see this diagnosis. You might have more of this if you deal with a population of, for example, nursing home patients that have memory issues and somehow they get taken off of their thyroid hormone when they're admitted to the facility. I've seen a couple of those cases over the years, very rarely young people. And the reason for that is because hypothyroidism that's caused, for example, by Hashimoto is usually a slow fade. There's rarely an abrupt cutoff. They almost always fade to myxedema. What I like to use this term in the medical record, though, is so that anybody looking at this can understand that at some point I or another doctor saw a TSH that was very high. Because these patients can come to you on thyroid hormone, and you might question, do they really need it or not? And if you know that they've previously had a TSH of, I had one once, a TSH of 1,000, okay, that you probably should never take that patient off of thyroid hormone. So I like to use myxedema in that case, even if they've never been in a near comatose state. These patients with myxedema coma do need some rapid dosing of thyroid hormone. Generally, they need to be in the hospital and IV given by IV. But if they're fairly well, you can do it outside the hospital. So we've certainly seen that a lot in the history of endocrinology. Those patients generally are going to be hyponatremic, hypoventilating. Some have hypoglycemia, and you want to consider the possibility that they have coexistent adrenal insufficiency. You don't want to add thyroid hormone in the mix when they're adrenally insufficient and untreated. So generally in these very severe cases, you want to test them for thyroid hormone deficiency, to test them for adrenal insufficiency along with their thyroid hormone deficiency. And you don't want to fully replace their thyroid hormone until you've at least partially treated their adrenals. So if this patient comes into your hospital and is in the ICU or the ER, you might want to test them for adrenal insufficiency, and while you're waiting for those labs to come back, you might want to go ahead and initiate steroids just in case, so that you don't precipitate an adrenal crisis by giving them thyroid hormone. The etiology of primary hypohidrotic would be, for the most part, in the United States or first world countries, Hashimoto. In the worldwide scenario, we would see endemic goiter from iodine deficiency. Thyroidectomy, of course, radioactive iodine and external radiation. External radiation is seen a lot. I don't see a lot of hypothyroidism after external radiation in my clinical practice. I was trained in suburban Detroit in an osteopathic teaching hospital where the endocrinologist ran the nuclear medicine department, and we gave everybody radioactive iodine. And we gave everybody radioactive iodine that even possibly could consider it. And at the time, it was certainly standard of care. And now it's less and less the standard of care. For hyperthyroidism, yes. For thyroid cancer, not as much as it used to be. So this is one that's probably going down. I usually give patients the option of how they want to be treated. Congenital hypothyroidism is uncommon, usually tested with heel stick. When you give iodine, you can get the Wolff-Chaikoff effect, which is hypothyroidism after iodine. That you probably are seeing, but don't realize that's what you're seeing. And iodine deficiency, of course, is extremely uncommon in the United States. Treatment with lithium and amiodarone can cause hypothyroidism. And treatment with antithyroid medicine, of course, is intended to cause hypothyroidism. Generally, you should see docs only using methimazole. Propylthiouracil has had a problem with liver failure in children, and that's the disuse of that has been extrapolated across. If you do write for PTU in current day, the pharmacy will give the patient a note that says, do you really want to take this? This is a really bad drug kind of scenario. They give them a little handout. So you'll get some pitchback on whether you should be using PTU or not, and I think that's reliable information. Secondary hypothyroidism, the sources would be hypothalamic from radiation trauma, infiltrative neoplastic disease, pituitary similar, including necrosis or infarction of the pituitary, and resistant to thyroid hormone can be generalized, resulting in what appears to be secondary hypothyroidism. It's probably more common than we really recognize in the day-to-day work. Primary versus secondary, you want to look at what is the end organ hormone, free T4 and T3, versus how it responds, how the body responds with TSH. Low free T4 and a normal TSH is an inappropriate pituitary response to the low free T4, except in the case of the hospital near me that doesn't know how to run a free T4. And then low T4, high TSH, of course, is an appropriate response. If you have a 35-year-old gentleman who comes in nervous with insomnia, diaphoresis, palpitations, tachycardia, goiter with a brewy, vitiligo suggesting autoimmunity, proptosis, might be appear like this, a patient of mine from suburban Detroit with what looks like proptosis and or possibly just eyelid retraction. He had a goiter and he was hypothyroid, primary hyperthyroidism, HYPER thyroidism. This gentleman also had a history of hyperthyroidism. He was actually hypothyroid at this time and he had persistent thyroid eye disease. This lady was hyper, and she had appears that her upper eyelids are retracting from, as the video goes on, I'm going to go back and show that one more time. The upper eyelids are sort of backing up as you watch her. You can see part of the sclera above. This lady, the same, she was markedly hyper-HYPER thyroid. She had eyelid retraction. Some patients have eyelid retraction and proptosis. Some patients just have the eyelid retraction, no proptosis. Sometimes you can tell it, as in these cases, but most times you have to measure it with an instrument called a Hertel instrument or exophthalmometer. Suburban Detroit lady from the north suburbs who had very large goiter. This was actually after two treatments with radioactive iodine, still had a goiter. She probably should have had surgery rather than radioactive iodine. She was so markedly hyperthyroid. Most patients that present with a goiter like this, though, are euthyroid. So if you have a goiter and you have normal thyroid function, you have an anatomic problem that has happened because the patient has some type of thyroid dysfunction that has corrected itself by forming a goiter. This gentleman is a Nevada patient who had huge goiter, was hyper-HYPER thyroid. Go back and show you that one more time. What I suggest that you do when you see a patient like this, this was a young guy. When I put my hand around his neck, it sort of just felt like a full neck, and I wasn't quite sure whether it was goiter or not. I usually have him take a sip of water and swallow. The thyroid should move up. Sometimes with this, you're still not sure what you're feeling, so I suggest that you back off, have him swallow a few times in front of you, and then you can see his goiter's going all the way out, out to the outskirts of his neck there. So these patients will present with high free T4, low or absent TSH. I usually order a T3 total as well. And this is the only instance in which I order a free T3, which is a patient that is on estrogen, is pregnant, or is on birth control pills with estrogen. Free thyroxine index would be high. Thyroglobulin is produced along with thyroid hormone, and if it's endogenous hyperthyroidism, the thyroglobulin level will be high as well. Most of these patients have antibodies to Hashimoto, but if they're hyper-HYPER thyroid, we don't call them Hashimoto. There used to be a term Hashitoxicosis, but generally the general term in a patient with no nodules and diffusely overactive thyroid would be Graves. They also will, periodically, we will order on a hyperthyroid patient with Graves. The test of choice potentially would be thyroid-stimulating immunoglobulin, or TSI. It's an indirect measure of receptor to TSH receptor antibodies. Thyroid imaging is done typically with uptake and scan. When I practiced in suburban Detroit, we used I-131 and for uptake and a technetium scan. Generally now I use I-123, which doesn't have any therapeutic purpose, but uptake and scan to determine whether the uptake is high or low and what we're going to do about that. This is a patient with a relatively euthyroid patient. You can see some background activity that suggests that all the activity is not going into the thyroid. I would suggest that you spend a little time on a nuclear thyroid imaging, probably not ultrasound, but nuclear thyroid imaging is an expectation that you know a little something about that in internal medicine as far as testing purposes. This patient here was on amiodarone, so when the patient had a thyroid scan before he came to my office, they saw poorly visualized thyroid. Those dots are a marker by the technician to say that you're in the neck. And in this scenario, the uptake was low at 2%. At 24 hours, greater than 30% would be high. And this patient had a 2% because he was loaded with plain iodine from amiodarone. This patient, on the upper pictures, basically you see white other than the dark thyroid, and that's because all the tracers in the thyroid in this hyper-HYPER thyroid patient. This was a patient with a hot nodule. This patient had a whole thyroid, but on the left side there was no dysfunction, and the right side had a hot nodule and was suppressing the left side. The treatment is antithyroid medicines, beta blockers, radioactive iodine. If you want to use antithyroid medicine, it is preferred in other than patients that are in their first trimester of pregnancy, should be on methimazole. So if you were asked something about an adult male patient with hyperthyroidism, PTU would be the wrong answer because we don't use it generally in adult male patients anymore. With antithyroid medicines, you need to follow, it is not advocated routinely to follow CBC and LFTs. I do. You're looking for agranulocytosis and elevated liver enzymes, and you want to stop it if you get that, and you want to question the use of it in any patient with active liver disease. Iodine-131 is highly effective, but we would not give it in a patient with a very large thyroid, and we would not routinely give it to a patient with thyroid eye disease. General surgery and anesthesia bear some risk, but if the thyroid is very large, you might want to pursue that. I usually send toxic nodular goiters to thyroid surgery as well, trying to figure out over time whether or not those nodules are an issue or not. You want to prep them with antithyroid medicines and beta blockers if possible. I had a patient earlier this last year who presented to me with a hyperthyroidism, having recently been on amiodarone, so we couldn't image him with nuclear, it would have been blank. We decided to temporarily give him antithyroid medicine. Shortly after he started the antithyroid medicine, he developed achalasia and couldn't swallow the antithyroid medicine and couldn't swallow any food. He was already losing weight from his thyroid. They got him in the hospital. We couldn't do surgery right away for achalasia. We were a little afraid because of the hyperthyroidism, and so we were going to treat him with that. He finally was able to be discharged, but shortly after that, he developed acute elevated liver enzymes, and it stopped the antithyroid medicine methimazole, so he could be on a beta blocker, but he couldn't have radioactive iodine because he was blocked with the iodine from amiodarone. And ultimately, he had to go to surgery in the hyperthyroid state, and he did survive, but I was a little afraid because we like to block them down before the time comes. Okay. We talked about the etiologies. Radioactive iodine uptakes, you want to understand that low uptake, if there's no iodine contamination, generally means thyroiditis. Those patients often get better on their own. High uptake is endogenous overproduction of thyroid hormone. And toxic nodular goiters and toxic nodules sometimes have a slightly elevated or even normal uptakes. The decision about whether they're hyper or not is the lab. Sorry. So in the terminology of thyroiditis, generally we talk about Hashimoto. Hashimoto is thyroiditis, but you often don't see the patient until they're in the hypothyroid stage. The importance of that diagnosis is if you have a patient with hyper-HRPER thyroid labs, the next step is a nuclear thyroid scan to see if the uptake is low or high. If the uptake is low and there's no iodine contamination, then you have thyroiditis, potentially subacute, possibly even Hashimoto. Those patients generally self-resolve. If they have elevated uptakes, that's endogenous overproduction of thyroid hormone. And the scenario is like a little sine wave. They start out with a low TSH, elevated sedimentation rate, and elevated free T4, and they generally, if they have a low, when that situation is present and they have a low uptake and no iodine contamination, then those patients are watch and wait, possibly treat them with beta blockers. You do not add antithyroid medicine. In that case, it won't work. That's the patient with the same. This is a patient of mine who actually did get amiodarone, but it was a long time before this, and we felt that his situation represented thyroiditis, and he was treated with, he was already on methimazole for about 6 months when he saw me, and his uptake on the original scan was low with presumptively not enough iodine contamination, and basically he needed a tincture of thyme. The thyroid scan then helps to determine the next step. So is the thyroid overproducing or is the thyroid inflamed? If the thyroid is inflamed, it's thyroiditis. It's a watch and wait. Overproducing is those previous treatments that we talked about. I'm just going to go over the biopsy thing. I'm going to switch to the next lecture after this slide. Biopsy which nodule? If you think you feel a thyroid nodule, the next step is ultrasound. to see if you have one nodule or more. If you think you feel a goiter, you probably should also do a thyroid ultrasound. You would only do a nuclear thyroid scan if the you'd only do a nuclear thyroid scan if the patient typically is in a hyperthyroid range. If you happen to have a nuclear thyroid scan, it's in, for some other reason besides hyperthyroidism, then you might want to look at that and see if you can correlate whether the nodule that you see is hot or not. If you have a hot nodule, generally it's not cancer. Physical examination important. Ultrasound characteristics are important. So if you have a lot of calcifications in a nodule or flow into a nodule, that makes it more suspicious. Generally, if they're less than a centimeter, you can watch and wait. And some thyroid cancer specialists in this country believe in the future we might watch and wait on things that we even think are thyroid cancer, as long as there is no lymph node involvement.